From PRI, Public Radio International.
North by Northwest isn't a film about what happens to Cary Grant. It's about what happens to his suit. The suit has the adventures. A gorgeous New York suit threading its way through America. The title sequence, in which the stark lines of a Madison Avenue office building are woven together, could be the construction of Cary in his suit right there. He gets knitted into his suit, into his job, before our very eyes.
You're listening to James Cromwell reading from Todd McEwen's story entitled Cary Grant's Suit, which we'll hear in its entirety later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Today's story selection has a wide geographical span, one story about a Russian immigrant in the city of London, and one that is set in the wide American West. We'll start with an excerpt from Rose Tremain's novel, The Road Home. Rose Tremain is the author of 9 novels and 3 story collections, and she broadcasts book reviews on London radio. The Road Home received the 2007 Orange Prize for Fiction. It takes us into the world of an impoverished Russian newcomer struggling to find a job in big, unfriendly London. The reader is a one-time Londoner as a child, our regular cast member, Paul Hecht.
On the coach, taking migrant workers from Eastern Europe to England, Lev dreamed about his remote village in the hills, his mother and his daughter left behind, and his beloved wife, Marina, who had died. He dreamed about his old job at the lumber yard, lost when the yard ran out of trees to cut down. Lev prayed to find work in London, and here he was now, on a hot July day, lugging his bag along a dirty London street. The thing he most longed to buy was a pair of dark glasses. The words of the Yarbo teacher of English came to him as he walked. When you ask for work, try to be polite. Our people are a proud people. We do not grovel, but neither are we rude. So say, for instance, excuse me for troubling you, but do you have anything you could give me? I am legal. Do you have anything you could give me? These words were difficult to remember, let alone say, and Lev was finding it hard each time he ventured into a shop or stood at a fast food counter to say anything at all. In a news agent's, a dimly lit old-fashioned place, he was filled with a sadness so sharp he could hardly breathe, so he said nothing except to ask for Russian cigarettes, and the fat girl behind the counter picked her nose and stared at him like a lunatic. Russian? Yes, Russian or Turkish. No, you won't find them, not around here. In a pizza parlor that felt cool with ceiling fans turning slowly among pinpoints of bright light, Lev waited near the door until a young waiter approached him. Smoking or non? Smoking or non? Do you have anything you could give me? Lev said, managing the difficult phrase correctly this time. I am legal. Sorry, said the waiter. No, excuse me. I am looking for work. Excuse me to trouble you. Oh, right, said the young man. Right. Well, hang on. And Lev watched the waiter walk away and disappear behind a door marked staff only. The place was almost empty, and other waiters stood aimlessly about wearing white shirts and red bow ties staring at Lev. The noise of the ceiling fans reminded Lev of the old ice rink at Barin, where he and Marina used to skate, holding on to the backs of chairs and where the freezing air smelled of disinfectant. When the young waiter returned, he said, Sorry, the manager's popped out. Popped? Said Lev. Yes, out. But there's nothing at the moment. No jobs. Sorry. Okay, said Lev. The bag was beginning to bother him, not just its heaviness, but the sight of it, containing, as it did, all that he'd brought with him of his former life. He imagined that somehow its contents were visible to all, and that his pitiful possessions would be derided. He had a further worry about it. Every time he set it down, the vodka bottles clanked together, and this was embarrassing, as though he were an inept grey telling the world what he had to sell. He wished he'd asked Sulima if he could leave the bag at the Champions B&B, but he was stuck with it now, as though it were part of his body. He came to a skip parked in the gutter and noticed that among planks of wood, stained mattresses, and piles of rubble, a quantity of rusty metal had been thrown. Lev stopped and put down the bag and stared at the scrap metal and imagined what such a find would mean to Ina and how the tin would be hammered and beaten so fine it could be cut and shaped with small clippers like fingernails. Rust is beautiful, Ina often said. Rust does my work for me. Rust makes everything delicate in time. Lev leaned on the edge of the skip. Anxiety about Ina was something from which he'd always suffered, even as a child, noticing that somehow, in a way that he couldn't describe precisely, his mother appeared ghostly, as though in the race through life she was an entrant nobody had seen, and who crept in last, always last, with worry in her eyes. Lev often wished this wasn't so, but it was so, and now, for years, Ina had spent her days making jewelry for other women, women for whom one didn't have to feel any particular sorrow, women with confident smiles and fashion boots, women who smoked and laughed and defied the world. Ina had never defied the world. She sat in shadow in a wood cabin, lit by a paraffin lamp that whispered like a living and breathing thing, and her workbench was covered with metal shavings and lengths of copper wire, and her hands were burned here and there by the hot torch and the soldering irons, and as time wound on, her eyesight was becoming poor. Lev knew that nobody wanted to think about the day when that eyesight failed. But she will see Princess Diana, Lev told himself now. He could imagine Ina propping up the card at the back of her workbench and letting the white paraffin light illuminate the rose-blushed skin and the hesitant smile, and then sitting back in her chair to gaze at these lost things and at the fascinating intricacy of the diamond tiara. And Maya would come into the cabin sometimes and stare at Diana, too. And once in a while, not often, the two of them might turn the card around to reread the words he'd written. I am going to find a job today. Lev picked up his bag and heard the bottles clank. He cursed himself for daydreaming. Daydreaming may have been all right during the lunch hour at the bar in Lumberyard, but you couldn't daydream and survive in cities like Gleach or Yore, let alone in London. Cities are fucking circuses, Rudy once remarked, and people like you and me are the dancing bears. So dance on, comrade. Dance on or feel the whip. The heat was rising again. You could feel it coming off the stained pavement, see it shimmering above the cars. Lev prided himself on being strong, a strong, lean-limbed man, but now he felt himself begin to stagger. Sweat ran down his forehead. The other people in the street started to look grotesque to him, fat and mocking and sick. He'd somehow naively imagined that most English people would look something like Alec Guinness in The Bridge on the River Kwai, thin and quizzical with startled eyes, or like Margaret Thatcher, hurrying along with purpose like an indigo bird. But now, in this place, they appeared indolent and ugly, and their heads were shaved or their hair was dyed, and many of them sucked cans of cola as they walked, like anxious babies. And Lev thought that something catastrophic had happened to them, something nobody mentioned but which was there in their faces and in the clumsy, slouching way they moved. Lev walked into a cool, brightly lit place called Ahmed's Kebabs. An Arab man was cleaning the tiled floor with bleach. Behind a counter, a gray cone of meat revolved on a perpendicular grill. A chill cabinet had been stocked with torn lettuce, chopped tomatoes, and breads of different kinds. A large glass-fronted fridge was filled with cans of cold drinks. Lev put down his bag, and the Arab man turned and looked at him while he squeezed out his mop. "Excuse me," said Lev, "do you have anything to give me?" The Arab man picked up the bucket and mop and took it behind the counter, and then he turned and examined Lev. His eyes were worried and wild, and his hair was glossy and disorderly, like Rudy's. "Sit down," he said. Against the counter were lined up three chrome and plastic stools, so Lev hoisted himself onto one of these and rested his arms on the cool countertop. The Arab man set down a paper plate. He took a flowery bread pocket from the chill cabinet and filled it with some of the torn lettuce, and then he walked to the meat cone and deftly shaved off a few slices and put these into the pocket and set it down in front of Lev on the paper plate. Lev stared at it. The meat smelled of goat. The Arab was at the drinks refrigerator now. He took out a green-colored can, snapped open the ring pull, and put it beside the plate with the bread and meat. "Drink," he said. Lev thanked the man and slowly pulled the can toward him. With the other hand, he wiped the sweat off his forehead. Then he lifted the can to his mouth and drank, and the Arab man watched him intently. The water was fizzy and felt almost scratchy on Lev's tongue, but it was beautifully cool, so he kept drinking, and as he drank, he remembered Marina begging for water that was cold and had no taste, and then crying with rage and saying that hospital water was tepid and tasted of the sewer. "I am Ahmed," said the Arab man. "Please eat. On the house." "Excuse me," said Lev. "You ask if there was anything I could give you. Well, I give you this food and water. Where are you from? Eastern Europe somewhere? So eat. My kebab meat is very good, and for you, it is free." Free. Lev knew this word very well. His English teacher had explained to him that the West described itself as the free world, and these words had fascinated him across months and months of time. But how was one supposed to imagine this freedom? In Lev's dreams, it had often become a black road laid straight and true to a flat horizon where a few birds looped and turned against a white sky. But there was something austere and unforgiving about this landscape, so he'd said to Rudy, "I don't know what it really means." And Rudy had replied, "You don't know, Lev, because you've put no vehicles on the f***ing road. Freedom is speed. Freedom is horsepower and torque. Freedom is four wheels under your arms." Lev thanked Ahmed again for the free food and water. He tried to eat the kebab thing, but gave up after one mouthful. He longed to smoke, but his last two packs of cigarettes were deep in his bag, and he was too embarrassed to start searching for them. "So," said Ahmed, "you want work. What work do you want?"
"Any work," said Lev.
"Well," said Ahmed, "you're lucky. You came to the right place, because I am a Muslim."
"Yes," said Lev. The Quran teaches that deeds of unselfish kindness will be rewarded in heaven. I've given you precious food, and for this unselfishness I will find reward. But now I shall go further. I am going to give you work. Lev waited. He wasn't sure how much he'd understood. Ahmed asked him his name and what city he'd come from, and Lev told him, and Ahmed smiled and said, "A man may travel far, but his heart may be slow to catch up." "Sorry," said Lev. "Take no notice. I like to invent proverbs." Ahmed's smile turned into a wide grin and then into laughter, and the laughter echoed all around the tiled and empty surfaces, and Lev thought, "Suddenly he's playing games with me, and the food and the water will not be free." And then Ahmed disappeared through a plastic fly curtain, very like the one Ina hung from her door lintel in summer, all colors but faded with sunshine and time, and Lev found himself alone. He went to his bag and, with hands that shook, rummaged about until he found the cigarettes, then tore open the packet and lit up, using the plastic lighter that he'd almost given to the Sikh washroom attendant at the station. He inhaled deeply, loving that first pull, feeling the smoke begin to steady him as he went back to the plastic seat and waited. He sat very still, smoking with concentration. The goat meat kept turning on its automatic spit. In a mirrored surface near it, Lev could see the street behind him and the slow traffic and the heavy-bellied people slouching past. A long time seemed to pass before Ahmed returned, and onto the countertop he put a tall cardboard box containing an overflowing pile of black and white leaflets on which the name Ahmed's Kebabs was written in twirly, backward-sloping script. Ahmed banged his fist down proudly onto the pile. "Your work," he said. "Deliver leaflets. Okay?" "Yes." "Yes. All round this neighborhood, everything residential, smart houses, shabby houses, flats, B&Bs, every private door. Check the basements especially. Many kebab people live in basements. Don't bother with the hotels. Every leaflet you post in, I pay you 2 pence. 10 houses, 20 pence. 100 houses, £2. Perhaps you are a godless man, Lev, but today Allah has smiled on you, eh?" There was the question of the bag. Because it contained everything Lev owned, he didn't want to be parted from it, but he knew he wouldn't be able to walk from house to house encumbered by it. He considered hoisting it onto his back, sticking his arms through the two handles, but he saw how it would weigh him down, so Lev told himself calmly to trust Ahmed and leave the bag with him and not think about it, because the things it contained were valueless, except to him. Before setting off, Lev forced himself to eat a few mouthfuls of the goat sandwich. Something would have to sustain him through the hours that lay ahead when the heat of midday would arrive and he would be lost in this heat, lost in the labyrinth of gray streets. But he felt cheerful all the same. On this job, he wouldn't be required to speak or to understand other people speaking to him. He'd be alone again with his own familiar reveries. Ahmed put half the leaflets into a plastic carrier bag and handed this to Lev. Lev was unable to judge how many leaflets were in the bag, but it was heavy, and he could tell that the plastic was going to bite into his hands. He wished he had with him the little canvas satchel he used to carry to school long ago, when the school in Auror still had its iron bell, and eagles could be seen in the hills above. He found himself wondering what had become of the bell and what had become of the eagles, but knew the timing of these thoughts was somehow inappropriate and that they had to be banished. "Most things disappear," Lev heard Rudy say. "Just make sure some of them disappear into your own pocket." He walked out into the sunshine. He passed a flower stall filled with roses, lilies, and cornflowers, and the scent of these in the heart of the city surprised Lev, as though he had imagined flowers only gave off any perfume when the air was silent. He knew that he should begin straight away delivering the leaflet, so he turned off the busy Earl's Court Road and found himself in a street of tall houses, not unlike the one he'd imagined inhabited by the immigrants making vodka out of potatoes, except that there was a solid kind of grandeur about the buildings he hadn't quite anticipated. Some of them were smart, with newly painted railings around them and fat pillars shining white or cream in the hot day. Others looked neglected, almost broken down, with cracks in the window ledges and garbage bags dumped on the front steps. And Lev saw that this cohabitation of restored and dilapidated things was everywhere he looked. And he found this consoling, as though at last he'd found some evidence of war damage in London that no one had been able to erase. He took out a handful of Ahmed's leaflets and put them through the letterbox of the first house. Under Ahmed's kebabs were written the words, "Best luxury halal meat. Best prices in your area. Eat in or take away. Friendly service at all times." But only some of these words had any meaning for Lev. Best, he knew, was an important concept, one seldom alluded to in his country, except by people like Rudy, who yearned to adorn himself with marvels, so that even his boots had to be worthy of admiration, and his shaving balm possess powers of seduction over men and women alike. Friendly service, Lev saw, as a contradiction. Remembering the few restaurants he'd ever visited in his country, in the days when Marina was alive, and he'd wanted to show her how much he prized her by offering her a nice dinner. The waiters and waitresses had behaved like labor camp guards, slamming down dishes of sinewy meat, sloshing out wine from dirty carafes, snatching their plates away before their meal was finished. "Why don't any of you smile?" Marina had once asked a surly waiter in a stained apron, and the boy, for he was a boy, really, and not yet a man, had looked at her, astonished. "To smile at the customers wouldn't cost you anything," Marina had continued gently, but the boy had looked away. "You're wrong," he said. "To smile would cost us our dignity." And after he'd hurried back to the kitchen, stamp, stamp, stamp in his heavy shoes, carrying the plates and the glasses and the empty carafe on a tilting tray, Marina had taken Lev's hand and said, "Now I feel pity for the boy. Before I felt fury, and now I feel pity. And I was happier with the fury." Marina. It was important not to start thinking about her now. It was essential to Lev's survival not to lose himself in dreams of her. He descended some steps into a basement area and found, almost hidden under the pavement, a tiny garden planted with bay trees and lavender and big hydrangea bushes struggling toward the light. A tabby cat lay curled on the low windowsill of the basement flat and barely opened an eye as Lev took out a few more leaflets and put them through the brightly painted yellow door. Next to the yellow door was a bell with two names above, Kowalski and Shepherd. Lev stood for a moment, looking at these names and at the yellow door, and then at the garden, which had been made out of very few things, but which was so beautiful in its small way that envy of these people, Kowalski and Shepherd, stabbed at him suddenly with surprising force. He imagined them returning from their well-paid jobs, watering their plants, feeding the cat, ordering kebabs from Ahmed, buying wine or vodka, sitting close together at their table, eating and laughing and smoking, and then going hand in hand into their bedroom as the night came down. And he thought, "My life will never be like theirs. Never." Lev walked on. The The weight of the leaflets in the carrier bag became lighter as he completed the first three streets and came into a quiet square where children played on a rough lawn safe behind railings and where the air was scented with privet. He was in a trance of delivery now. Walk up the front steps, grab the leaflets, hurl them through the letterbox, walk down the front steps, go down again into the basement, examine the number of names, select the right number of leaflets, throw them in, climb back into the sunlight of the street, pass on to the next house. His legs ached a little. He wore his leather cap low against the midday glare, but he wasn't unhappy with his task. Before long, he calculated that he'd earned £1. Lev rested for a while, leaning on the gate that opened on the square garden, watching the children on some swings and their young mothers, dressed in tight little vests and jeans, lounging on the grass in the shade of a mulberry tree. He lit a cigarette, and it tasted good, and the scent of privet seemed to be drawn with the smoke into his lungs, and there was something in this combination that made Lev feel alert and fearless, and he thought that when the night came, he'd return here and sleep under the mulberry and watch the life that was going on in the houses all around him, and in this way acquire a new vision of London, a secret vision, and this cheered him that he'd chosen a place to sleep somewhere free, somewhere secret, a place where he could keep watch. But now Lev saw that the young mothers had turned and were all staring at him and then whispering together. He looked down. He kept the cigarette cupped in his palm. One of the women got up and began marching toward him. He looked at her from under the peak of his cap. She was pale and pretty, with freckled arms, and she arrived very close to him so that he could smell her sun lotion. "This is a private garden," she said. "Yes," said Lev. "Yes. This is a garden for residents only, so can you go away, please?" Lev looked beyond the young woman to her group of friends, and he saw that they'd called the children from the swings and had their arms around them, and he understood that they thought him a criminal of the kind who was bullied and ostracized at the Yarbal Institute of Correction and of whom society did not wish to speak. "You are thinking," he began, then stopped. He ran short of words, but felt that even if he'd known the words, he couldn't have brought himself to say them about himself. The freckled young woman stood confronting him with her hands on her hips. Lev wanted to say to her that he had a daughter the age of the children in the garden, that even now Maya would be walking home from school with her small satchel and her worn shoes. "Okay," said the young woman. "You're leaving now, right?" Lev shook his head, trying to show her that she'd read him wrong, that he was a good man, a loving father, but this shaking of his head alarmed the woman, and she called to her friends, "He's not going. Someone call the police." "No," said Lev, "no police." "Then leave." "I am new," said Lev. "I am only looking my way through many streets." The woman sighed as one of her friends joined her. "Nutter," she said, "foreign nutter, probably harmless." "Okay," said the friend approaching Lev. "Stay off, right? Comprendo?" By late afternoon, and with all the leaflets delivered, hunger and thirst began to torment Lev. He thought longingly of Lydia's hard-boiled eggs. He knew he was lost now. He wished he'd left a trail of leaflets to guide him back the way he'd come. He stood and looked around him, staring left and right, and then he set off again, trying to remember what route he'd followed. And when at last he reached Ahmed's kebab shop, it was crowded with a group of Arab men eating meat in the bread pouches and drinking coffee from paper cups. The smell of the goat meat now seemed almost perfumed and sweet to Lev, and he made his way to Ahmed's counter and put down the empty bag. "Leaflets gone," he said. Ahmed's back was turned to Lev. He was carving meat from the cone, sweat gleaming on his arms. "What I hope, my friend," Ahmed said after a moment, "is that you put everyone through a letterbox. I have had workers who dump my leaflets in the f***ing trash and then ask me for money, and although I am a very kind Muslim, that makes me hopping." Around him, the Arab men began laughing. Were they laughing about hopping? Lev recalled his English teacher saying, in a foreign language, meaning sometimes arrives a little while after the words have been spoken. Ahmed began filling 3 bread pockets with meat and salad. He set these on the counter for his Arab friends and then moved away to his coffee machine. All Lev could glean by way of meaning was that Ahmed's mood had changed since the morning. He watched him serve the coffee and take money and put this into his sophisticated cash register, which had no ringing bell like cash registered in Lev's country, but only made a quiet little buzzing sound of appreciation as its drawer opened to receive the notes. Lev stared at the cash register. He saw Ahmed's wide hand poised above it, and after a moment's hesitation, the hand snatched out a green note and closed the drawer. Ahmed crossed over to where Lev stood. He put the note down on the counter. "There you are," he said. £5, 200 leaflets. I'm being generous, okay? And I'm trusting you because I am a very kind man. You like a coffee?" "Thank you," said Lev. "Thank you very much."
Paul Hecht read an excerpt from The Road Home by Rose Tremain. We had a chance to talk with Paul about his career and his 25 years of reading short fiction for us.
You know, I'm very proud of the fact that I go back to the very beginning. I've read a story every year in selected shorts, started, and I've loved a lot of the people that I've read. People say, well, how do you play all the different parts and then be the narrator too? And I say, well, you don't. When a woman speaks, all I do is just soften my voice slightly. And the author has said, and then Mary said lovingly, you know, I've always loved you. And so the audience does the work just as the audience does the work in radio drama. The other thing about reading a story is you have to remember that the person who's listening is listening usually in a very intimate place. They may be listening in bed with headphones. They may be listening in the privacy of their car. So what one has to remember is that one is really basically whispering into their ears. Sometimes I'll get into the car or put on my headphones and get on my bike and turn it on, and suddenly I'll be aware of a very familiar voice with very familiar line readings. And I think, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I know who that is. The whole atmosphere at Symphony Space is so marvelous for those of us who are lucky enough to be part of the selected shorts gang, because it's total pin drop time. I mean, people sit there, they've disappeared totally into this ancient give and take.
That was Paul Hecht. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. We've had stories about people of every kind and even many about all sorts of animals, but I think this is the first time we're featuring a piece about a man's suit. an impeccably tailored, perfectly fitting, wrinkle-resistant suit. The story is entitled Cary Grant's Suit, and it was written by Todd McEwen, a Columbia University graduate who's been living in Scotland since 1981. And yes, it's about that beautifully pressed garment that Cary Grant is wearing in the Alfred Hitchcock movie North by Northwest, as the crop duster airplane tries to chase him through the cornfields, or as he scrambles around the rocky faces of Mount Rushmore, all without damage to the suit. The reader is the usually impeccably tailored James Cromwell, whether he's playing Farmer Hoggett in the movie Babe or the Duke of Edinburgh. Hear him now read Todd McEwen's Cary Grant's Suit.
North by Northwest isn't a film about what happens to Cary Grant. It's about what happens to his suit. The suit has the adventures. A gorgeous New York suit threading its way through America. The title sequence, in which the stark lines of a Madison Avenue office building are woven together, could be the construction of Cary in his suit right there. He gets knitted into his suit, into his job, before our very eyes. Indeed, some of the popular suitings of that time, windowpane or Glen plaid, perfectly complemented office buildings. Cary's suit reflects New York, identifies him as a thrusting exec, but also arms him, protects him. What else is a suit for? Reflects and protects, a slogan that Cary's character, Roger Thornhill, might have come up with himself. But, as Thoreau wrote, a man who has at length found something to do will not need a new suit to do it in. Cary may cut quite a figure, but as a person, he is meaningless so far. We find him in the suit, but certainly he has not found himself or what to do. The recent idiom of calling a guy a suit if you don't like him, consider him a flunky or a waste of space, applies to Cary at the beginning of the film. This suit comes barreling out of the elevator, yammering business trivialities a mile a minute, almost with the energy of the entire building. The suit moves with its secretary into the hot evening sun, where we can get a good look at it. It's a real beauty, a perfectly tailored, gracefully falling, lightweight, dusty blue. It might be a gown, you know. It's fun to think of it as dusty blue because of what befalls it later. It's by far the best suit in the movie. In the movies, perhaps in the whole world. The villains, James Mason and Martin Landau, wear suits of funereal, sinister, though sleek and pricey black, while their greasy henchmen run around in off-the-peg brownie crap. The professor, head of intelligence, bumbles about in pipe-smoked tweed and a revolting shirt of old man blue. In 1959, the year North by Northwest was released, America was a white shirt and black suit nation. The revolution, if you want to dignify it that way, was 10 years off. There's a nice photograph of Ernst Lehman, who wrote this picture, sitting in Hitchcock's office, a typically late 50s black and white office, natty in a white shirt and narrow black tie. Some could make this look good, but if you were forced to dress this way, if you worked for IBM, say, it contributed only to the general gloominess of the age. Sometimes you can find yourself wondering if life itself was conducted in color then. Even the summer of love was largely photographed in black and white. Don't let anyone kid you. The 60s were dreary. Outside, on Madison, the white shirts blind you, but not one of them is quite so white as Cary's. As someone with a slight experience of applying theatrical makeup, I have no idea how they kept it off these white, white collars. Drives me nuts. Non-streaky Cary is daring and dashing in the most amazing suit in New York. His silk tie is exactly one shade darker than the suit, his socks exactly one shade lighter. In the cab, he tells his secretary to remind him to think thin, which commands us to regard his suit, how it lies on his physique. A friend of mine in politics once said to me, "I love wearing suits. They're like pajamas. You can go around all day doing business in your pajamas." It has to be said that his suits were pretty nice, particularly so for Boston. Whether he meant that he did his business half asleep, only his constituents could say. The suit, Kerry inside it, strides with confidence into the Plaza Hotel. Nothing bad happens to it until one of the greasy henchmen grasps Kerry by the shoulder. "We are already in love with this suit, and it feels like a real violation." They've mistaken Roger Thornhill for a federal agent called George Kaplan. They bundle him into a cab and shoot out to Long Island. Not much manhandling yet. In fact, Martin Landau is impressed. He's a well-tailored one, isn't he? He loves the suit. But next moment, Kerry tries to escape. There's a real struggle. They force all that bourbon down his throat. He later thinks, "They'll find liquor stains on the sofa. But if there was that much violence, why aren't there any on the suit?" Cut to Kerry being stuffed into the Mercedes-Benz. He's managed to get completely without even mussing his hair. On his crazy drink drive, the collar of his jacket is turned up the wrong way around. That's all. He gets arrested, jerked around by the cops, conks out on the table, and appears before the judge next morning, and the suit and the shirt both look great. But this is the point in the picture when you start to get worried about Kerry's personal hygiene. Start to itch. Cops generally aren't too open-handed with showers. It's back to the bad guy's house, then back to the Plaza, looking good. I always hope he'll grab a quick shower in the hotel room. He keeps gravitating towards the bathroom. There's a good suit moment when he tries on one belonging to Kaplan, the guy he's looking for, who doesn't exist. Kaplan's suits are stodgy, old-fashioned, unbelievably heavy for a summer in New York, with turnips on the trousers. So much for the sartorial acumen of the U.S. government. "I don't think that one does anything for you," says Kerry's mom. And boy, is she right. She also jokes that Kaplan, maybe, has his suits mended by invisible weavers, which is what happens to Kerry's suit throughout the picture. His suit is like the victim of repeated cartoon violence. In the next shot, it's always fine. Off to the United Nations, where the secretariat looks even more like Kerry than his own office building. He sublimely matches a number of modern wall coverings and stone walls here and throughout the picture. He pulls a knife out of a guy, but doesn't get any blood on himself. There's a curious lack of blood in North by Northwest. It must be all to save the suit, though there must be 10 or even 20 of them in reserve, no? Kerry evades the bad guys again and scoots over to Grand Central Station where they have, or had, showers. But he's too busy. This is what's ingenious about this picture, at least as far as the suit goes. Kerry's able to travel all over the country in just this one beautiful suit because the weather has been planned for the suit by Ernest Lehman. It's the perfect weather for an adventure in this suit. And that's why it happens. At the same time, there's a creepiness about the whole escapade generated by our own fears that in some situation, Kerry may be inappropriately dressed. Kerry Grant? And this will hinder him or that the thin covering of civilization the suit provides him with will be pierced, and here he is, thousands of miles from home, without not so much as a top coat. Men ought to admit that they can experience suit fear, the fear of suddenly being too cold in the suit you thought would do, in Glen Cove, Long Island, even on a summer night, or too hot, the prairie, to come. Exposed, vulnerable. Carrie does have some money, though, we know that, so he could buy something to wear if he had to, assuming his wallet isn't destroyed along with the suit. But it would be too traumatic to see this suit getting totaled. That would be way beyond Hitchcock's level of sadism. This feeling of exposure, the idea of having suddenly to make a desperate journey in just the clothes you have on, comes up in the 39 Steps book and movie. Richard Hannay is alone in a desolate landscape in inappropriate town clothes when a menacing autogyro spots him from the air. In the suit are a number of subtle tools for Carrie. It's so well cut, you can't tell if he's even carrying a wallet. Turns out he is. Here's what he's got in that suit. He goes all the way from New York to Chicago to the face of Mount Rushmore with a monogrammed book of matches, his wallet and some nickels, a pencil stub, a hanky, a newspaper clipping, and his sunglasses. But these are shortly to be demolished when Eva Marie Saint folds him into the upper berth in her compartment. Really, this is a good thing, because Cary Grant in dark glasses looks appallingly guilty. All this stuff fits into the pockets of the most wonderful suit in the world. Does the suit get crushed in the upper berth as his Ray-Bans are smashed? No. Cary keeps his jacket on in the makeout scene that follows. The suit defines him. He's not going to take off the jacket. I know this feeling. When Cary and Eva Marie walk from the train into LaSalle Street Station the next morning, he's wearing a purloined Red Caps outfit, open at the neck, and showing a triangle of snowy white undershirt. She has the same white triangle peeping from under the jacket of her dark suit, which rather matches the suit James Mason wore the night before. But here are two little white triangles who spent the night together on the train. There might be an opportunity here in Chicago for a shower, you itch. But it looks like he chooses merely to loosen his shirt and have a quick shave with Eva Marie's minuscule razor. His suit was temporarily stuffed into her luggage while he made his exit from the train in disguise. Has it suffered? Has it hell? It looks like $1 million. His shirt still blazes out. But now comes the suit's greatest trial. The crop dusting scene at Prairie Stop. This begins with Carrie and the farmer eyeing up each other's attire across a hot highway. The farmer wears a clean, though saggy, brown suit and a slouchy hat. Going to town? Here, Carrie gets covered in dust from giant trucks passing by, a deliberate and somewhat comic attack on the suit. Sweats like a pig. Or should, we do. Has to throw himself into the dirt, gets sprayed with DDT by an evil crop duster plane, then practically gets run over by a tanker. He grapples with its greasy undercarriage and writhes around on the asphalt. After all this, and having fled the scene in a stolen pickup truck, Cary has only his hanky with which to make himself presentable at the Chicago Hotel, where he thinks Kaplan is staying. Still, he's done a pretty good job with it. He looks like he's been teaching school all afternoon, just a bit chalky. His tie is still pressed, and the shirt is white, even the collar and cuffs. You cannot violate the white shirt of the 60s. You might kill me, but you will never kill this shirt. Eva Marie enters the scene in a really luxurious red and black dress, a sign of her decadent double life with James Mason. And it's all pretty uncomfortable because now Carrie is dirty. A dirty man, loose in civilization, too easily spotted. But the suit gets rescued here. Eva Marie tells Carrie she'll have dinner with him if he'll let the valet clean it. Carrie tells her that when he was a kid, he wouldn't let his mother undress him. Eva Marie says, "You're a big boy now." Carrie's growing up. From an impressive but essentially childish New Yorker executive, and you suppose a playboy, into a man taking charge of his life. He grows into his suit over the course of the adventure and finds a life and wife to suit him. In another sense, though, maybe he has a boner. He's been sniffing around Eva Marie and suggesting a skirmish. This is all very good neurotic 50s movie dialogue. I don't know who suffered more, who was the more repressed, the writer, the actors, or the audience in those days. So, Carrie takes off the suit, goes into the shower, she gives it to the valet, and she splits. The suit is not there, so Carrie is not there. We get to see that he wears yellow boxers, another sign that he's a daring guy in a creative profession. Phew. Once Carrie gets to the auction house, the suit is perfectly restored. That valet is some little sponger and presser. Eva Marie and the bad guys are bidding on a pre-Columbian figure. It's not very well dressed. It's only wearing shorts. Carrie gets into a fist fight, no blood, is arrested, taken to the airport, put on a plane to Rapid City. The next day, it's hot as blazes at Mount Rushmore, but the shirt is clean, the suit fantastically smooth. A hot breeze rustles it a little. The monument itself is wearing a rock-like suit in solidarity with Carrie. He's turning into a patriotic rock, too. Ignore what I said up there. Eva Marie arrives in mourning, essentially, black and dove gray. She's about to have to leave Carrie and her entire life behind. James Mason is in a weird English fop getup. To suggest that he's never been one of us, he's not long for these shores now. He's frail. Eva Marie shoots Carrie. No blood again, of course, it's a charade. But wouldn't you think the CIA would have some fake blood? How else are they going to put this over on James Mason? He's not an idiot. But you can't do this to the suit. Now the suit is in the woods for the reconciliation scene with Eva Marie. The suit doesn't look too bad in the woods. And you reflect that Mount Rushmore seems a very formal national park. There were a lot of people dressed up in the cafeteria paying their respects. Carrie gets punched out for trying to interfere between the professor and Eva Marie. And when he wakes up, the suit has been confiscated. The professor has locked him in a hospital room with only a towel to wear. He's not going anywhere, although you feel a lot of relief that he's had his second shower of the picture. But then comes the real act of betrayal. The professor brings Cary Grant a set of hideous clothes from some awful menswear shop in Rapid City. You can just imagine the smell of it. Banlon shirts and cheap belts. He gives him an off-white, white shirt, a pair of black slacks, white socks, and icky black slip-on shoes. You get the creeps because this whole thing is about insecurity, exposure, clothing anxiety. When Carrie escapes out to the window ledge, he's inching his way along in a pair of brand new slip-ons, which may not fit. Your feet and hands start to sweat at this moment. But something major has occurred. Carrie is now in black and white. Everything is clear to him, and he can act decisively outside the suit in order to be able to win it back. It's all wonderfully Arthurian. Now he knows what to do. And for us, there's the thrill of a badly dressed Carrie. The situation is now a real emergency. Now Carrie crawls off the hospital lintels and up the stone wall of James Mason's millionaire's hideaway. It looks like the face of the office building at the beginning, the rectangles of a snazzy suit. And in this white shirt with no jacket, Carrie is a sitting duck in the bright moonlight. A New Yorker without a jacket. It's too frightening. Delightful, though, to discover that in the end, when Carrie and Eva Marie are on the train back to New York, she in virginal white nightie, he's got his suit back. He's not wearing the jacket, but those are definitely the suit trousers, and his original shoes, and the gorgeous socks. The shirt has remained impeccable. Like Arthur, he needs a woman to be safe, to be alive, and to be king, even on Madison Avenue. Now he really knows how to wear that suit. I managed to acquire a pair of trousers several years ago that were somewhat like Carrie's. They weren't tailor-made. They weren't the same quality of material, of course, but the color was really close, and the hang of them wasn't too bad. And they turned out to be lucky trousers. Very lucky. Until I burned a hole in them. The veneer of civilization is thin, fellas. Exceedingly thin.
Cary Grant's Suit by Todd McEwen, read for us by James Cromwell. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.